You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 8th of March 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
This is about the Ukrainian people, their struggle against a murderous attack on their liberty and a violent attack on cities in Ukraine that have done absolutely nothing to deserve it.
We'll have the latest on the invasion in Ukraine as the United Nations calls on Kiev and Moscow to allow safe passage for civilians to flee. Plus,
there's been a major divide for at least 20 years between this kumbaya approach of Western Europe and the warnings of Eastern Europe.
Former President of Estonia, Tuomas Hendrik Ilves, weighs in on what the invasion in Ukraine means for the Baltic states. Later, we'll look ahead to the presidential elections in South Korea, and we'll have a flick through today's papers too. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Russia warned that it would stop its natural gas supply to Europe in response to the West's sanctions. The official list of candidates running for the French presidency will be published today. And tens of thousands of residents in southwest Sydney were ordered to evacuate overnight as torrential rains continue to flood several large suburbs in the city. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Now we cross to Ukraine for an update on the situation overnight. Yaroslav Yurchison, a Ukrainian MP and the former chief of Transparency International Ukraine, is on the line. And Bettina Renz is a professor of international security at Nottingham University and an expert on Russia, also joins us to analyse the situation.
Really, we have the same situation, what we have several day and night. All Ukrainian children must be hide in shelters because Russia bombing not only arm object or object which have any connection with war, but civilian buildings. We have more than 200 school destroyed totally. We have destroyed kindergarten and hospitals because of Russia bombing. The worst situation is on the east and near the Kharkiv, one of the biggest city in Ukraine, in the eastern part of Ukraine. I can say 5 days along, bombing not stopped in general. The worst, the two bad situation we have on the south, near the big cities Mykolaiv and Kherson. It's the center of region on the south. And near the Kiev, we have destroying small cities like Hostomel or Bucha. It's like a small city near the capital of Kiev. And we try to organize and humanitarian corridors. But Russia start fired civilian people with children, with pets. Only then they start to move. So we yesterday we have killed a family. Russian military start fired, and five people was killed. Two of them was children, 100 children now killed on Ukraine. And it's the worst what we really have. So Russia not fight with like people. They fight like animals, and they try to destroy our will and push us to capitulation. But we will not do that. Why? Because we clearly understand that Ukraine now is frontier of Western civilization. We're fighting for democracy, for freedom of speech, election democracy. And Russia, what really want? Putin have their own dream to rebuild even not USSR but Russia empire. Because of that, not only Ukraine in dangerous, and we see that unfriendly moving on the northern border of Russia, near Finland, near Baltic country. So really we have a strong feeling that if our Western partners not create no-fly zone under Ukraine, not give us weapon, and not take decision about gas and oil embargo for Russia, the next steps of Putin will be destroying or attack European country.
Thank you, Yaroslav. Bettina, there were peace talks yesterday, which again ended up without any agreement. Are Russia's demands unchanging?
Yes, I mean, Russia or the Kremlin is attempting to put forward like that they're being reasonable about this in any way, shape or form, that they're prepared to talk. But it is very clear that what they are suggesting, there is nothing like any kind of compromise included in that. What they're demanding now is the same or even worse of what they demanded for the last couple of months or even years of Ukraine. And it is clear that these kind of demands are just simply unacceptable for Ukraine, because they essentially would be giving up Ukraine's sovereignty, Ukraine's ability to decide its own domestic and foreign policy. And this is obviously not something that Ukraine can accept. All of the proposals and the suggestions that Russia has put forward, also with regard to the humanitarian corridors that then would lead Ukrainian civilians only into Russia or Belarus, are obviously clearly unacceptable. I think a lot of Russia's discourse in that way or rhetoric is also directed domestically within Russia, where still this propaganda continues about portraying this horrendous war going on in Ukraine as part of Ukraine's fault, saying, you know, we are offering humanitarian corridors, but the Ukrainians don't want to accept. This is clearly disingenuous from the Kremlin's point of view, and it is clear that Ukraine cannot accept these kind of proposals. Mm.
As Yaroslav was saying, the West has repeatedly refused a no-fly zone over Ukraine for fear of being dragged into the conflict. But it has been reported today that a senior military figure in the West has said that NATO could fight now or later, and a no-fly zone might become necessary. So do you think it's inevitable, given Putin's rhetoric, that this conflict will escalate to global level?
Well, the issue is, of course, that all war has the tendency to escalate. It already has escalated, obviously, to incredible levels in terms of the way that the Russian armed forces are going about that. But obviously, it cannot be excluded that this will escalate further. I'm not working for NATO, so I don't make decisions. But as far as I understand it, of course, NATO had ruled out the option of a no-fly zone because they had ruled out a military option in terms of aiding Ukraine. And of course, a no-fly zone also is a military option because in order for it to be enforced, of course, Russian aircraft, for example, would need to be shot down. I agree with the official that it is impossible to say how this will develop further. Obviously, if Russia is not stopped, there is obviously also the tendency that this will spill beyond Ukraine and into NATO countries. But obviously, we should bear in mind what the overall implications of that would be.
Mm. Mm. Yaroslav, meanwhile, President Zelensky remains defiant. He makes a point of addressing the country daily. Yesterday, he even told the world exactly where he was physically. What's been his latest statement, and how safe is he?
Not unsafe. We knew about not less than five trying to assassinate him. He's still in Kyiv. We know that our Western partners proposed to him proposed to evacuate him, but he clearly understands that he is a leader of nation, and he must be in Kyiv, in capital, and be in the center of war. Really, I'm from opposite party. I'm from Polish party who was in opposition. Now we don't have opposition. We have several pro-Russia MPs who escape in Russia and trying, it's funny, but trying to hide on in Western country. Why? Because even pro-Russia, pro-Kremlin's politicians don't want to live in Russia. They want to live in Western society with democracy, with possibility to freely visiting a different country, not in Russia ghetto, really. Now our president tried to speak day by day with Western leaders, explain why we really need to stop Putin in Ukraine and stop this war as early as we can, because if Western leaders will be afraid about nuclear weapon, so nuclear weapon not only in Kremlin, we have nuclear weapon in China, in Iraq, so the level of terroristic demands of not democracy from the non-democracy country can be more tough. Zelensky became a leader of nation. He not now a leader of just one party or who worked for them in 2019. Why? Because he fights. He like a pattern of for all Ukrainians. And tomorrow we have Russia killed one of the mayor of small city, Hostomel, near the Kyiv. Why they killed him? Because don't want to collaborate with Russia invaders, and he was killed when he gave bread for people. So in time of humanitarian missions, so. Really, we see that our leaders, our MPs, even our governors are under attack. Many of diversants try to capture him, them, but it's war. We're ready to fight to the victory, but still we're fighting with the second largest army in the world. Yes, this army are not so effective as NATO army. This army not effective as even Ukrainian army, but we need airplanes. And for us, it's very necessary to receive them, even old-fashioned from Poland or our NATO country. But we're losing the time. And day by day, we have hundreds of people killed, civilian key people. And day by day, this blood of these people, of these children, not only on a Putin hand, it's blood two on the hand of Western leaders who are undecisive, who not take decision, who not help us to stop this maniac, who not will stop till he did he have possibility to fight.
Bettina, it's clear that there are appalling crimes against humanity taking place here. There was a hearing at the International Court of Justice yesterday. What was the outcome?
Well, the problem, and I'm not an expert in international law, but the problem with any international law, of course, is that the countries included in it or need to be prepared to actually abide by the rules or by the norms or by the agreements. There is obviously no movement from the point of view of Russia to accept any kind of condemnation, either in the UN or any kind of ruling or investigation by the International Criminal Court. And of course, there are very limited options for enforcing that. From the Russian point of view, I mean, the rhetoric becomes more and more ridiculous in terms of how this war is justified. Yesterday, the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, said that Russian actions in Ukraine are aimed at preventing a war from happening in Ukraine in the future, which is, of course, absolutely ludicrous, given this absolutely brutal and unprovoked war that is going on in Ukraine at the moment. So obviously, it is really important, international condemnation and getting more support for that also from countries that haven't really spoken out so clearly against Russia, against the Kremlin at this point. But I would not hold my breath that any of these initiatives will change the Kremlin's mind at this point in terms of what they're doing in Ukraine.
I mean, as Yaroslav says, unless the West acts, it does have blood on its hands. At the top of the show, we heard British Prime Minister Boris Johnson condemn this war. He's been giving out a lot of bluster about it. But as of yesterday, the UK had only allowed 50 Ukrainian refugees to enter the country. I mean, this just seems to be that the talk is not matching the actions. Likewise with sanctions. We know the EU relies on Russia for 40% of its gas needs, about 27% of oil. People are considering further sanctions. Not everyone's united on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at this point, obviously, strong words of support and solidarity for Ukraine are not enough. There has been enough of that for the last couple of years. And of course, there is a difference in terms of responding, obviously, with weapons and military support. But also, of course, the humanitarian situation is absolutely critical at the moment. And I also obviously would very much like to see the UK playing a clearer role there, because I think this is important also for the future. You know, what one thing that Putin has always said is that Western values don't really exist. There's a lot of moral decay and so on. And when the West and the UK speak about humanitarian reasons or intervention, for example, they are not really worried about humanitarian issues. All it is about is money and power. So I think it is absolutely essential to prove this wrong and not to give Putin more ammunition, really, for discrediting any kind of democratic values, humanitarianism, and so on by not pulling our weight now. And yes, the visa issue, we've been struggling. I myself have been struggling all day yesterday trying to help a Ukrainian PhD student of mine to get a visa. And he's not even applying as a refugee. It has been very, very difficult. And I really hope that the UK government will change its position on this matter.
I mean, we know that some Russian oligarchs have been sanctioned, but do you think that the seizure of a yacht or a mansion can change things? I mean, how much power do oligarchs actually have?
I mean, of course, it's not the case that oligarchs will have their yacht seized or some money and then will somehow be able to get rid of President Putin as a result. Obviously, sanctions. Well, the problem is that the West's options are limited at the moment in terms of what to do unless a military option is considered. So obviously, all the sanctions, the more sanctions, the better, I suppose, at this moment. But they will not provide any quick result. It is very clear that the Kremlin is not willing to back down at this moment. I think Putin more or less sees this as now or never, as more or less crunch time. So there were expectations in Russia that the Russian economy would be hit. Of course, how long Russia will withstand that, how long this will be viable is something to be seen, but I don't expect that this will have significant effects quickly. We might be looking at years, if not decades, here.
Yaroslav, as you've said, many, many Ukrainians are trying to leave. The ceasefire to enable evacuation has repeatedly failed. I find it puzzling that Russia is saying that civilians might flee, but only to Russia and Belarus. Why would that be the case? I mean, surely an influx of war-traumatized Ukrainians would only further inflame dissent in Russia.
So really, it's very hard to understand the logic of Russia, because it's logic of something what happened previously. Logic of Cold War, or logic of even past, it's a better say, than a nation fighting between themselves and trying to destroy their neighborhoods. It's imperial logic which are not even consist in the Western world. Because of that, it's very hard to explain why Russia to try do in that way. But all civilians which are now on stay on territory which are under control of Russia, for Russia it's a hostage. It's a really people with one of the main scenario that Russia use today. It's the same scenario that they used in Chechnya in 19th, when they destroy a city, Grozny. Then they destroy many Syrians cities. They want to push on our government to destroy our will for fighting because of hundreds and thousands civilian death, because of hostages, because of many children who caught or killed on occupied territory. But Ukrainian will fight. Many of my friends now who don't have any experience or military experience take a weapon, ordinary people take a weapon and try to save their districts, their buildings. And on the beginning of war, 25 of February, I was in my native district in Kyiv, Obolon, and Russia troops come to this Obolon with armed machine, with tanks, and we don't have army forces in these districts. We have only ordinary people with Kalashnikov, with very light weapon, and my neighborhood stopped Russia invaders till the military forces come to districts and push them out from Kyiv and from nearest cities. So really, Kremlin don't understand. They live in old-fashioned values. Mm. Their people are not even cast anything. So they using their men like a statistic. So yes, killed 100 or 200. It doesn't matter because we have goal. We want to destroy Ukraine. For Ukrainians, every life are very necessary. Mm. Because of that, we try to push Russia to create humanitarian corridors. We ask for Red Cross and our humanitarian organization to help us on that. But Russia not, for Russia state, for Kremlin, human life, it's nothing.
Yaroslav, thank you very much indeed. That's Yaroslav Yurchisin and Bettina Rentz also. Thank you to you. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, as the invasion in Ukraine continues to stoke fears across the region, Finland and Estonia have agreed to further strengthen bilateral cooperation. Indeed, Baltic nations understand what Russian invasions are like and have long warned about the dangers posed by Vladimir Putin. Earlier, Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke to the former president of Estonia, Tumas Hendrik Ilves. Andrew began by asking President Ilves whether he felt the invasion in Ukraine might serve as an I told you so moment to Western Europe.
Well, I would say it's been that for most countries of Eastern Europe, in fact, not merely the Baltic states. And I've been annoying some people simply by recalling their statements in the past. But it is true that there's been a major divide for at least 20 years, even before Putin's ascent, between this kumbaya approach of Western Europe and the warnings of Eastern Europe. And usually it meant being Eastern Europeans, especially the Baltic states, being called paranoid, unrealistic, and so forth, not taking into account that the treatment of these countries was very different from the kind of smarmy, sycophantic attitudes displayed by Russia toward the West Europeans. And so, I mean, it's very much a part of this narrative that was exposed by Sergei Lavrov right after New Year's, when he said, criticizing the new members of the European, well, of the European Union, but more importantly of NATO, it was translated as the countries of the former Warsaw Pact left orphaned by the collapse of the Soviet Union. But that was like a polite translation. What he said actually in Russian was left without a master. And if you recall, George Kennan in 1946, 47 wrote, neighbors of Russia can only be vassals or enemies. And the loss of vassal status combined with this master, you know, left without masters, I think sums up very much the what all of these countries toward the east, well, east of the Oder, have had to deal with for 20 years, even more. I mean, just arrogant, overbearing, boorish behavior that was fairly well masked, as I said, in the sycophantic behavior of Russian diplomats towards Germany, France, the UK, and in fact, the United States.
I did want to go back in your career a bit before you became president, and you did two stints of as Minister of Foreign Affairs for Estonia. And if I've done the maths right, you would have overlapped with Yevgeny Primakov and Igor Ivanov in Russia at that time. What kind of relationship were you able to have back then? Did you feel like they took Estonia seriously as a sovereign state?
No, especially not Yevgeny Primakov, who was as boorish KGB thug as the best of them. Really, the only foreign minister that I would say that, and who was really outstanding, unfortunately living in Florida today, but the only one who really would rank up there among the best of foreign ministers in sort of savvy and intelligence, reading, as well as polite personal style, was Andrei Kozarev, who just last week tweeted out his advice is for everyone to resign from the Russian foreign ministry if they want to preserve their honor.
Just going back to that time, though, and talking to Primakov in particular, did you get the sense that the Russians even then regarded the fact of the Baltic states' independence as a sort of temporary inconvenience and something they intended to do something about eventually?
It was very much veiled, though I recall a concrete example when we were conducting our border negotiations for a border treaty in 1994-95. And this was, we still don't have a border treaty, but in any case. But the negotiations, part of the negotiations was a sub-treaty on simplified border crossing procedures, which is fairly standard that people who live near a border have, it's easier for them to cross back and forth. So my suggestion to the negotiating team was to take the Finnish-Russian simplified border crossing regime and then use the replace function on the computer and just put Estonia everywhere where it says Finland. And so they did that. They made that suggestion. And Ambassador Svirin, their negotiator, looked suddenly very stern and said, "You are not Finland. You will never be Finland. We will never treat you like Finland," which was kind of did take people aback. But I think that's indicative of the same kind of notion of we are the masters and you are the vassals approach. And, you know, don't even think that we will treat you as an equal.
I mean, you will have noticed the last couple of weeks, there's been an amount of suggestion from people that maybe if we wind back to the early 90s, we should have deferred to this sensibility of Russia, let them have some sort of buffer zone. This suggestion is always, of course, made by people who would not have had to live in such a buffer zone themselves. Was that ever discussed, the idea of a sort of Finlandization for the Baltic states, or were you always determined on membership of NATO and the EU?
Well, we were determined to join NATO, and I was the one as foreign minister and came in and said, "You're not going to get into NATO until you're well on your way in getting into the European Union," because countries like Germany, France, and the UK and Italy would veto any application to NATO on our part, but would not be able to do so were we members of the European Union.
And that was the former president of Estonia, Tomas Hendrik Ilves, speaking to Andrew Muller. And you can listen to the interview in full when it airs at 10 a.m. this Friday on The Big Interview. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Russia's warned that it would stop its natural gas supply to Europe in response to the West's sanctions. The United States is pushing for its allies to ban Russian oil imports as punishment for Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. But Germany has rejected the idea of an embargo. Meanwhile, the UN has called on Ukraine and Russia to ensure safe passage for civilians fleeing fighting. The official list of candidates running for the French presidency will be published today. The country will vote in a two-round presidential election on the 10th and 24th of April. And flood warnings stretched across Australia's east coast as torrential rains flooded several large suburbs in Sydney. Tens of thousands of residents in southwest Sydney were ordered to evacuate overnight. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. South Korea votes for a new president tomorrow in what's been dubbed the unlikable election because the disapproval ratings of both leading candidates are so high. It's been a toxic campaign, which has been about vicious personal attacks more than main policy issues, property prices and the widening income inequality. In fact, the viciousness became physical yesterday when the leader of the ruling party was hospitalised after being attacked by a hammer. Well, joining me now from Seoul is James Fretwell, an analyst at NK News. Thanks for coming on the show, James. Can you tell us more about these two leading candidates?
Sure. As you said, this is the unlikable election because they're generally so unpopular with the vast majority of the South Korean populace. They're very different. They come from quite different backgrounds. We have the ruling Democratic Party's Lee Jae-myung, whose childhood poverty forced him to work at a factory, where he sustained an injury to his left arm that he still has today. He taught himself, eventually became a human rights lawyer and the governor of Gyeonggi Province. And then we also have the main conservative opposition People Power Party's Yoon Suk-yeol, who was the former chief prosecutor, actually, under the current administration, and he helped convict former President Park Geun-hye, but he fell out with current President Moon Jae-in over attempts to reform the prosecution and joined the opposition party. And it's a neck and neck race at the moment. Recently, the third most popular candidate, An Chol-soo of the People's Party, he was running, but he decided to merge campaigns with Yoon Suk-yeol. So before that, they were neck and neck, Yoon and Lee, at around 40% each. An had about 10%. So this merger could turn the table in Yoon's favor, but we'll have to see. The election will be held tomorrow.
Now, there's been a great deal about gender politics in the election. The candidates have been accused of pandering to sexism to win the votes of young men who regard women's advancement as a threat to their financial security. Can you tell us more about misogyny in this campaign?
Yes, as you said, the main issues have been, corruption and kind of mudslinging over the various controversies of the candidates. But simmering under the surface as well, there is this big gender divide in South Korea. So traditionally, South Korea has been a very patriarchal society. Men have to do an 18-month mandatory military service because of North Korea, obviously. Women don't have to do this. And there are also a few top-class universities that are only available for women. So some men in South Korea feel that they are being discriminated against. But on the other side, women also have a lot to say about discrimination in South Korean society. The Economist Glass Ceiling Index was released yesterday. This measures gender pay gap, representation in senior management and top-level political jobs, etc. And South Korea has consistently ranked at the bottom of 29 countries over the past few years. The average wage for women in 2020 was around 67% of that of men, according to the Ministry of Employment and Labour. And women also fall victim to a large number of sexual crimes. South Korea has a really big problem with hidden camera filming. So people will take tiny cameras and hide them in public places such as restrooms and secretly film women in these areas and perhaps upload these videos onto the internet in chat rooms, use them for blackmail. The BBC reported last year that there were more than 30,000 cases of hidden camera filming were reported to the South Korean police between 2013 and 2018. This has become an election issue. Yoon Suk-yeol has been appealing to male voters, actually, young male voters who feel that they are being discriminated against. He's pledged to abolish the Ministry of Gender Equality and Family, for example. But recently, in the last few days leading up to the election, Lee and Yoon have softened their stances on feminism and tried to appeal to female voters as well on social media. So yes, we'll see what happens. But a lot of South Korean women don't really feel that either Yoon or Lee are representing their best interests in a society that's where they can fall victim to a lot of discrimination and sexual crimes.
James, thank you very much indeed. And that was James Fretwell of NK News speaking to us from Seoul. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. Well, it's just coming up to 8:38 in Zurich, 7:38 here in London. Workers at a nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine are now under the command of the Russian military leader, whose forces seized the facility last week. The initial attack caused a fire in one of the outer buildings, which saw Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky issue a grave warning. Early in the conflict, Moscow's forces also claimed the site of the old Chernobyl power plant. Well, how worried should we be about these developments? Monocle's Lillian Fawcett reports.
Ukrainian As Russian forces attacked Europe's largest nuclear power plant, a video received by the New York Times shows employees pleading with them over the building's loudspeakers. Immediately stop firing. You're endangering the safety of the entire world. The attack caused a fire in one of the Zaporizhia nuclear facility's outer buildings. It was later fully extinguished and didn't reach any of the six reactors. But for many locals, it brought up traumatic memories of the world's most catastrophic nuclear disaster less than 40 years ago. Andrei Kozol lives in the city of Zaporizhia. He spoke to me on Friday morning.
Shock, devastation, disorientation among my friends, family, relatives, actually in every citizen that we know. Everyone remembers well the catastrophe of the Chernobyl power station. Middle-aged and all people remember how many people died in that catastrophe, how bad the consequences were. The provincial power station that was yesterday attacked by the Russian terrorists is 10 times bigger than Chernobyl.
Russian forces seized the plant, and reports suggest its staff are now under their command. Malcolm Grimston, who researches nuclear policy at Imperial College London, told Monocle 24 on Friday that the site has strategic importance for Moscow.
Ukraine gets more than half of its electricity from nuclear power. And so these plants are potentially enormous assets in the post-war scenarios, or most of them.
Initial reports of elevated radiation levels around the plant were later disproven. Malcolm Grimston says it appears Russian forces were not trying to cause a nuclear incident.
And from what we could see of last night, the fire seemed to be in an office building. For example, the building on fire had windows, and none of the serious working parts of a nuclear plant have windows. And the artillery being used looked far more consistent with a desire to take the plant rather than to cause a radiological incident.
The Zaporizhia plant is built differently from Chernobyl, with additional safety measures in case of events like an earthquake. But it's not built to withstand missile fire. If the facility's cooling system is damaged, that could be a disaster. The attack renewed calls from many Ukrainians for more military support from the West, especially in protecting Ukrainian airspace. Anti-corruption activist and former civil servant Yulia Marushevska spoke to Monocle 24 on Friday.
Did you know that we didn't get fighter jets yet? We didn't have missile defense. So I'm not asking like for words of support. I'm not asking for some humanitarian aid. We need weapons to defend Ukraine and to defend Europe and to stop this nuclear terrorism. That's what we really need for the moment.
Over a million Ukrainians have now fled to neighboring countries, with countless more internally displaced. But Andrei is staying put.
After the Zaporizhia power station was seized by the Russians, me and my family, the same as everyone else, are staying at home and carrying on the fight for independence against the Russian occupiers.
This may not be the last we hear about nuclear energy in this conflict, given how reliant Ukraine is on its 15 nuclear power plants. That has strategic importance for Moscow and historic importance for Ukraine.
That was Monocle's Lillian Fawcett, with thanks to Zhenya Schickel for help with translation. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is Latika Burke, who's a journalist with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Good morning to you, Latika.
Good morning, Georgina.
The front page of the Times newspaper here in London is utterly horrifying. Would you describe that image to us?
Yes, it's impossible to miss this front page, Georgina. And why is because it is basically covered with this enormous photograph of a Ukrainian woman. Her name is Yelena Bolichenko. She's 55 years old. And her face is, as the article describes, it's written by Anthony Lloyd, the Times veteran war correspondent. It's a map of Putin's bombardment of the city of Kharkiv. Her face is shredded. You can see all the wound marks right across basically the entirety of her face. But it's also covered in these huge green-blue marks. And you learn in the article that these are the marks of the green disinfectant used to treat her wounds. Now, there's about five or six of these marks all across her face. Then you look closer at this woman's eye, her eyes, and you can see that one of them is basically not working. It's almost closed and very wounded and bruised. The other is open, but we learn in the article that she's lucky to have, 50% sight in that other eye. And so this article is a very, very powerful article. It goes through the human cost of Putin's war in Ukraine through the many victims that he's met in one of Kharkiv's hospitals, or Kharkiv, I should say, is the correct pronunciation. And Anthony Lloyd has gone to this hospital. He's not saying where it is, because the officials there in Kharkiv have asked him to keep it secret, because they're so worried, of course, that Putin will target it if its location is revealed. And we learn the stories of several of these victims. One is a 35-year-old woman. I mean, that's just a couple of years younger than me. She is running through her fifth-floor apartment. It's bombed. She grabs the hand of her husband and child. They fall two floors. They're buried under rubble. 10 other people around them die. And the quote from that particular woman is, "We're just waiting for Putin to come to Kharkiv streets to discuss how much his army is making an effort to avoid killing civilians." And Anthony Lloyd reports that she spat that quote out. Then she says, come and check on us here, Vladimir Putin. See how accurate your artillery is." And this is probably one of the most powerful human toll stories that I have read so far in this war on Ukraine. Mm.
Anthony Lloyd is a beautiful, beautiful writer, and I would recommend his book, My War Gone By, I Miss It So, which is all about his time in Bosnia and also in Chechnya. Really beautifully written, and that sense of this kind of lyricism almost comes across in his war reporting. Ukraine serves as a wake-up call for Taiwan over a China threat. That's the FT. What are they saying?
Yeah, this is a really interesting article by the FT's correspondent in Taipei, in Taiwan. And she goes through the big sea change in thinking that they're having in Taiwan. And this certainly accords with what a lot of the intelligence bodies in Australia are fearing and thinking, which is that Taiwan is seriously underestimating what it needs to do to prepare itself for the Russia-style takeover or invasion that China is expected to launch on that island within, say, the next 5 to 10 years. And she reports, Catherine Hill reports in the FT, that there are now a bunch of very young people, including one 22-year-old economics student that she talks to, who are now actually contemplating how they would arm themselves, how they would fight off an invasion. And they're now watching the Ukrainians, particularly the young Ukrainians, arm themselves. Some of these guys, of course, have never held weapons in Ukraine and are picking up guns. And we've seen that with young women as well, picking up guns. I was listening to a great story the other day where a woman was talking about having to cut her manicure, forego her lovely long nails to be able to pick up and fire a gun. Well, these are the sorts of stories that are getting through to the people in Taiwan. And she also reports on this really interesting visit by a US intelligence figure, a security figure, to Taiwan last week. The White House delegation led by Michael Mullen. Now, he's a former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the US. He was in Taipei last week And it is believed, according to this report, that he was discussing exactly this with Taipei officials. How are you going to arm yourselves? What have you got in the terms of weaponry? Are you ready? And how are you going to defend yourselves when and if that time comes? And of course, a lot of people think that this is now more likely than ever, because Putin has shown us that these two autocrats, Xi and Putin, who are twins to each other, as they very proudly declared last month, are embarking on their long drawn out plans to take the territory they believe is rightfully theirs.
Yeah, well, both those dictators were under discussion by two powerful women yesterday. It is, of course, International Women's Day today. And one of the best speeches, I think, by a woman ever was by Julia Gillard, her wonderful, wonderful takedown in Parliament. Here she was talking to Theresa May.
Yes, a really interesting chat last night at her Global Women's Institute for Leadership at King's College in London. And the two of them sat down for a long chat about gender equity, women in leadership, their time in politics, of course. But they did discuss the war in Ukraine. And Theresa May made this very interesting point, and I've written this up for the City Morning Herald, that she actually thinks there were too many eyes on China. They were so worried in the West about the threat posed by China that they took their eye off the ball in Europe. And that gave Putin, as she describes it, he's an opportunist. He saw the moment and launched his bid for Ukraine. Now, they were also discussing the rise of strongmen in politics. And Gillard was asking May, why is it that democracies are choosing this autocratic style strongman leader? And Theresa May made this very, very interesting point that she thinks that social media has aggravated this absolutism in politics, where these political leaders get up and say, well, you're either 100% with me, or you're either 100% against me. And that means there's this new kind of casting of enemies in politics, even if they're from your own side and simply trying for a more constructive dialogue or negotiation, say, on Brexit, than perhaps was possible for Theresa May to strike. So I think a lot of food for thought there.
Absolutely. I love the fact that Gillard made a joke about her institute conducting research on men with messy hair.
You know, I didn't get the feeling that either of them were fans of Boris Johnson.
Latika, very many thanks for joining us. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. It's time now to have an update on how the conflict in Ukraine is affecting the aviation industry with Peter Morris, who's chief economist for Ascend by Cirium. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning.
Regarding Ukraine, what's been the effect of sanctions on aircraft ownership and operations, particularly in Russia?
Well, I think the first step was when 36 countries have shut their airspace to Russian aircraft, and that has then been reciprocated. One of the consequences is the increase in flight times between Europe and Asia in particular. Similarly, Aeroflot will now not be flying internationally from the 8th of March, as they've announced. And part of that is because the lessors, who have something like 500 aircraft in Russia, the leases have been terminated by the 28th of March. So as a consequence, everyone has to work out what does that mean. And what it means is, effectively, if an aircraft then leaves Russia, it can be impounded. Mm. So they are not leaving Russia. But the consequence is carries on insofar as the manufacturers will not be supporting the aircraft with spares. And similarly, the insurance position will become invalid. So it's a complete mess. And as a consequence, there's lessors worried about whether or not they can get their aircraft out. There are clearly Russians that want to travel within Russia and outside Russia that are going to be impacted by it. So of all the kind of economic effects, that's, to my mind, one of the most immediate.
Yeah. I mean, do you think Aeroflot can continue in any way, or it's just totally unviable?
Well, its international services are a relatively small proportion of its total operations. But the question is, what will be done with the aircraft, that clearly 500 aircraft leaving the fleet? potentially would render it not viable because you couldn't operate with just existing Russian aircraft. So again, this is sort of playing out, and the question is whether or not those aircraft will be released back to the lessors. But if they aren't, you know, you're in defiance of all the global international aviation agreements. And again, if an accident happens and you're not covered by insurance, you know, the kind of chaos just goes on and on.
Yeah. How are passengers able to get to and from Russia? Are there air links in and out?
Well, at the moment, travelling via the Middle East is feasible, and via Turkey as well. In fact, I think there have been more flights put on between Turkey and Russia. But clearly, there's a massive fracture in the number of operators. And clearly, the prices have gone through the roof in Moscow of people wanting to get out. So again, you know, just more chaos. But the thing is, what we don't know is the economic impact that's going to be within Russia and globally, and the effect on energy prices and so on, which again feeds back into aviation. So there's a certain number of knowns, but the reaction of both the Russian government and the Russian airlines is still unclear. And until those things become a bit clearer, it's just going to get worse.
Now, you mentioned that journey times for the rest of the world have gone up because of the closure of Russian airspace. Are there any other effects on international travel because of that ban?
Well, I think that there's probably an effect that you saw through the whole COVID crisis, which is passengers' perception of risk. So it may be that people travelling in the region are concerned and make fewer trips and so on and so forth. It could be that airlines route further round what they regard as the conflict zones. So, you know, that patch gets bigger and bigger and bigger in terms of the area that they don't want to fly through and that passengers then don't choose to fly through. And all of those are impacting costs.
I wonder if private jets of oligarchs are also being targeted.
Yes and no. I think the thing is they are largely registered in places like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and lots of non-Russian territories. So it's a question as to what the legal process can be to identify the ownership, because clearly there's a whole mass of holding companies that are involved in this, and they could be of any nationality. So actually identifying that it has a sort of flashing sign oligarch on board is really rather difficult.
Yeah. And finally, as we know, of course, fuel costs are going to rise. I wonder what effect that will have on the airline industry, and also what that means for jobs in the aviation sector.
Well, it's not good, but the relative good thing is that those airlines that have invested in the newer, more fuel-efficient aircraft, saving 10-15% or so of fuel, will actually benefit at the expense of people operating older aircraft that consume more fuel. In a sense, it's the price of fuel is a bit like an environmental tax. So it's gone up. And so the environmental tax goes. So anyone using large amounts of fuel gets hit more. So as there is the opportunity for people to purchase aircraft that actually have a higher level of efficiency, relatively they'll benefit. But overall, yes, it's bad.
Peter, thank you very much indeed. That was Peter Morris. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producer, Emma Searle, our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, Lillian Fawcett and Samson Mbogo. Our studio manager, Christy Evans, with editing assistance from Chris Ablakwa. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. Chris Chermak will be here on The Briefing, which is live at midday in London. And The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.